Okay, great.
Okay. So before we start with Dan's talk today, there's an announcement. We'll be having Journal Club this afternoon at 4 p.m. in here. You can sign up on Vox Charter and vote for papers that you want to discuss. The details should have been in an email a while ago. So without further ado, today we have Dan Grin from UChicago to tell us about Isaac Evercheck. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Dottie, for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to come to Perimeter. And there are so many cosmologists here now. It's just been a great day already, and look forward to chatting with all of you. I'm sort of going to jump around a little bit, but I'll try to stay on two topics today. And most of them have something to do with isocurvature. So there's my title. If you study isocurvature, it's actually a really bad joke about turning trajectories in field space, but I haven't quite put together the humor arrows, so figure that out for yourself. So I'm going to just sort of explore some ways we might get better leverage on whether or not the primordial fluctuations are truly adiabatic. One is this new horizon of CMB spectral distortions. If you asked me a week ago, I would tell you it's not a horizon anymore, and there will never be an instrument. And why would you want to build a space-based instrument to go look for B modes that violate the Lith bound anyway? Well, things have happened. And then I'll talk a little bit about an unconstrained isocurvature mode that we've now constrained, and a little bit about some future horizons. Before I talk, let's just stop and say, wow, maybe you guys have already done this. This signal I had nothing to do with, but it's pretty exciting. I had all but given up on the CMB, especially since some of my senior colleagues told me it was a waste of time because Kmax cubed is inappropriate units bigger than Lmax squared, so large-scale structure was the way to go. I don't know if that's true anymore. But, and of course, this signal may not be here in a little while. There are certainly systematics to check, so we should all proceed cautiously. But it's neat to be around.
It's not the value of R quoted in the paper.
What's that?
It's not the value of R quoted in the paper.
They give a range. They give 0.2, but foreground subtracted. No, sorry, these are just two values. One is, this is not with error bars. These are just two values. One is the foreground subtracted, and one is not. So I'm going to start by talking about CMB frequency spectrum distortions. And I apologize in advance for my voice. The winter has finally gotten the better of me. So I'm going to start by talking about CMB frequency spectrum distortions from isocurvature modes. This is work I've done in collaboration with Jens Kaluba, who probably quite a few of you know. So with that, let me get started on that and sort of try to parse this title for you. That'll be maybe half of this part of the talk, is making sure everyone knows the words in those title. So here's a little review of the, I like to call it the zoology of cosmic initial conditions. The one we all know and love is the adiabatic initial condition. If we imagine a single plane wave perturbation in our favorite species, the neutrinos, the cold dark matter, the photons, and the baryons, the adiabatic mode is one in which, on a mode-by-mode basis, all the fluctuations are spatially in phase. So that means there's no relative number density or entropy fluctuation between the particles. But via Poisson's equation, there is a total energy density perturbation and a potential perturbation. There are other modes, though. There's the so-called baryon isocurvature mode, where the baryons are out of phase with the photons. This mode carries no overall density perturbation, but it does carry an entropy fluctuation. I think I have to use the stick part of this. I can't keep a straight face. There are other modes. There's the CDM isocurvature mode, where the cold dark matter is offset relative to the photons, and likewise for neutrinos. And so we can ask what we actually know about the cosmic initial conditions. These actually offer a unique decomp, not a unique, but all cosmic density initial conditions can be expressed as linear combinations of these. So it's a powerful tool. Obviously, these aren't conserved under fluid evolution, so the observables are non-trivial. You have to run a Boltzmann code or at least write some simple analytic expressions. But these are a powerful way to decompose the primordial fluctuations. There's one really weird mode. Question?
So when people say isocurvature, usually this one do they mean because they don't usually specify it.
They usually would say the CDM isocurvature.
Okay. That's CDM versus everything else.
That's yeah, yeah. But the others are maybe thought to be the domain of exotica, but that's where I live, so that's why what I'm going to talk.
Why is one more exotic than the other?
Beats me. There's a really weird mode called the neutrino isocurvature mode, where you set up equal and opposite flows in the neutrinos and the photons at initial times. As far as I know, no one's written down a way to excite this mode, unless you have a large magnetic field in the early universe. Or not large, but some magnetic field that changes the way waves propagate. You get a magnetosonic mode, and so you can actually excite what you used to call the velocity mode. So we actually know sort of what the answer is. The adiabatic power spectrum probably looks fairly familiar because it goes through the data points, and the isocurvature power spectrum, not so much. This can actually be sort of understood simply that one of the main features here is that the acoustic peaks in the isocurvature modes are out of phase with those in the adiabatic modes. And crudely speaking, if you just write down a simple harmonic oscillator or a sound equation for the baryon-photon fluid, which is tightly coupled, you have two propagating modes, a cosine and a sine, and the isocurvature initial condition excites the sine mode, which is why the acoustic peaks are out of phase. I'll get to constraints in just a second, but let me say a few words about how you might excite these in the early universe. I'll get more detailed as I go on. So this so-called CDM isocurvature mode is often thought to be excited if the dark matter is all made of axions. And if the Pecci-Quinn phase transition is broken during inflation, you have another massless scalar that picks up Hawking-Gibbons fluctuations. This field has nothing to do with the physics of inflation, so it's an uncorrelated isocurvature mode. And so that's the axion type isocurvature. And then there's a curviton type isocurvature, where a single field is responsible for all the perturbations in the universe. And so whatever isocurvature fluctuation there is due to the detailed physics there ends up being correlated with the underlying adiabatic mode. That may sound a little contradictory, so I'll flesh that out a little more when I talk about the curviton model, which is now. So the whole point of the curviton model is that inflation is hard. So why not make inflation a little easier by having different fields inflate the universe and seed the primordial curvature fluctuation? So essentially, there's this famous slow roll expression for the curvature perturbation from inflation. So suppose that the parameters here, the Hubble parameter at mode horizon mode crossing and the slow roll parameter at the same epoch, suppose that they just conspire to give you a very small inflationary curvature perturbation. You could hypothesize that there's another field, the curviton, which is around during inflation, picks up the quantum fluctuations during inflation, but then takes over the energy density of the universe. And if the degrees of freedom that we see every day actually, or their quantum numbers, are generated by the curvitons, suppose baryon number or lepton number are generated by curviton decay, then their fluctuations are going to be correlated with the curviton fluctuation. So here's just one scenario where you can work out how things go. If you suppose that cold dark matter somehow, through some mysterious physics, is created before curviton dominance, during the usual inflationary epoch, it's going to have almost zero fluctuation, almost zero density fluctuation. So this delta C, this is the entropy fluctuation of cold dark matter relative to photons, this density fluctuation is going to be roughly zero. But the radiation is going to fall into the gravitational potential wells set up by the curviton fluctuations. So in this particular scenario, you end up with a gauge invariant curvature perturbation zeta, which is just proportional to the fluctuation in the curviton field multiplied by the fraction of energy density in the curviton. So that's just one scenario where you might get some isocurvature. And in this case, the isocurvature is going to be correlated with the underlying adiabatic fluctuation. Let me talk a little more about the axion case. In the axion case, the RMS value of the axion field is going to be something like the Hubble parameter during inflation. But because the axion is energetically subdominant, the curvature perturbation seeded by those fluctuations is going to be proportional to the fractional density fluctuation in the axion, which you might think is something like 1 part in 10 to the 5. But by hypothesis, the curviton is energetically subdominant. So you end up with a very small curvature perturbation seeded by axions, But you do get a relative number density fluctuation between the axions and the photons, which is still of order 1 part in 10 to the 5. So this is one scenario where you would have detectable isocurvature from axions. And there are constraints. So let me talk a little bit about those. You can imagine, in the curviton case, the entropy fluctuations follow the adiabatic fluctuations. So if you have a map of the CMB, and you've already measured the dominant adiabatic fluctuation, you know where to look for the curvature curviton-sourced entropy fluctuation. And so there's a tighter constraint in the correlated case. This is the constraint from WMAP. So the curviton-type fluctuation has an upper limit of 1%. And the axion type, because it's another Gaussian random independent field, it's allowed to have a larger fluctuation because you can sort of put it anywhere on the sky. Now, these constraints have actually gotten much better thanks to the work of et al. On the Planck team in 2013. The isocurvature, the overall, depending on those two assumptions I was just talking about, the amplitude can sort of range between 1 part in 10 to the 3 and 1 part in 10 to the 2. Now, there's one major caveat here, which is the analysis that you see in your run-of-the-mill, know how to subtract foregrounds, actually dealt with the data and built the instrument, APJ paper, which is probably what you should believe for most things anyway, by the actual team, probably because they have a lot of other things to do. They typically don't vary and allow all linear combinations of isocurvature at the same time. They don't allow arbitrary correlations. But sometimes people on that team will be curious, like here, Rachel Bean and Joe Dunkley, Pedro Ferreira, I think Costa Scortis and others, actually tried to generalize this assumption, allow all isocurvature modes, and just be completely empirical about it, allow arbitrary spectral indices. And when you do that, for the WMAP case, if you define the isocurvature fraction as just some sort of root mean squared sum of the fractional power in each mode, you can allow up to 50% of the primordial power to still be coming from isocurvature. So there's still room to explore. I don't know that anybody has done that exercise of unpinning these assumptions for the Planck data. I think that would be really interesting to see. It's the error bar in the upper limit. Yeah.
Okay.
And
why would you do that?
Well, that's a good question.
No, I think it's this actually. They like in the distributions when they allow the null to vary, they picked away.
Yeah, I think I think you're right, Dottie. I'm just remembering now. What it is there's low L tension, right? And one way you can get rid of low L tension is with an anti-correlated isocurvature mode. So there's some preference in the data for the actual presence of an isocurvature fluctuation. And as you say, if you just allow one mode at a time, there's a pretty tight upper limit. But if you allow these arbitrary combinations, you actually have some preference.
The paper appeared saying that if I said 2 is correct, R is 0.2. So it really reduces axioms.
Yes.
Right.
Dottie is the first author is right here, and the rest of the authors, 3/4 of the authors are in this room. Yeah, he's right here. I think that paper is correct. there are obviously some interesting assumptions you can play around with. But as Renee was just saying, it's an if-then paper. We're pointing out the intellectual possibility that if this detection stands the test of time, axions are indeed in trouble. But that doesn't stop us from still looking for them in other data sets. And by us, I don't mean the community. I actually mean us. So we're hedging our bets.
But I mean, actually, going back to this, this is like more than 5 sigma quote-unquote detection, it seems. So why nobody?
I want to go back and check those. There must be some caveat. I think you might have to have a very, I think you might need a very blue spectrum. But that doesn't make sense because the tension's at low L. I don't know. I'll have to go back and look at the paper.
I think you have to have neutrino isocurvature velocity have a blue spectrum because that's the one that has the first peak in phase with the adiabatic.
Oh, I see. So you put in the other stuff, and then you put in the neutrino
so
mode.
20%, even if you just do CI plus NID.
Right.
But then it's not a detection, then it's not a
blue. Right.
Half a dozen papers appeared this morning. Blue, red.
It's a Doppler shift. Let me quickly switch gears, because I'm sort of cobbling together the pieces of my talks. I've told you why isocurvature is interesting, and I'm going to remind you what CMB spectral distortions are. So some of you might be, no, I'm not going to make that joke. Here's the Kobe Firas black body, beautiful black body, theory black body, going through the data points. These are the 400 sigma error bars. So we've come a long way, but this is already amazing. And here are black bodies at other temperatures. There's slightly different temperature black body. And this red curve is I think, what was a straw man model. I don't think it's the steady state prediction. It's a tired light prediction, where photons don't decrease in number, but they just lose energy as cosmic time goes on to trick us into thinking galaxies are receding. And you'd get it. You can make a very specific prediction for what the frequency spectrum would look like, and it doesn't look like the data points. And one way you might imagine putting in a deviation from a black body is through a chemical potential or through a Compton Y-type distortion, the sort of CMB frequency distortion you see around a hot cluster of galaxies. So the limits on the global CMB black body from Kobe-Firas are chemical potential of 9 times 10 to the minus 5 and a Y parameter of 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5. And I'll talk a little bit more about what those mean and what the frequency space distortions actually look like. But the amazing thing, if you take the experimentalists at their word, as I think we usually should, is you can now improve on these limits by 3 to 4 orders of magnitude if you build a dedicated spectrometer to go look at the CMB again. And before I tell you about all the exotica I'd love to learn about by having someone do this, let me give you a quick cautionary tale. This was these are the frequency space data points from a rocket-borne experiment trying to measure the CMB frequency spectrum. I believe this solid line is the best fit black body, and these are the measured data points from that rocket-borne experiment. I believe it later turned out that the rocket door didn't quite open, and so what you're actually seeing is just the superposition of two black bodies. One of them is the CMB, and one is the door of the rocket. In the great tradition of if-then papers, or perhaps just then papers, there was an article, interesting theory paper, but trying to explain this result using a population of dust produced by an early generation of POP3 stars around a redshift of 50. Maybe that doesn't sound so exotic to early universe theorists, but I think in the world of star formation and reionization, that's pretty weird. And this went away. You know, Kobe-Firas came out, and I think that was one of these cases where the experimentalists, instead of showing 50 pictures of their instrument and how small the graduate students were compared to it throughout their talk before showing you the result, I've heard that when the Kobe team were giving talks, they would just flash the black body up, and a good fraction of the theorists in the room just left after that. But we can do better now. There are two proposals out there. One is the so-called Pixie mission. It's a $200 million class, NASA Explorer class mission. It's going after large-scale B-modes. But because they want to do a very nice foreground subtraction, with interferometry, they essentially synthesize all these different spectral channels. And so with that kind of sensitivity, you actually, for free, get a reasonably good measurement of the CMB frequency spectrum. The other proposal for measuring CMB frequency space distortions is something called PRISM. Maybe some of you are on the white paper even, I don't know. The idea was to put a 4-meter telescope with 10,000 bolometers, 30 frequency bands in space, and throw on a dedicated spectrometer on this. This would cost billions and billions of dollars. I think it's sort of B-pole on steroids. But you know, now we can hope and dream, you know, if this bicep detection holds up, that you know, maybe someday we'll get a better measurement of the CMB frequency spectrum. But what is it telling us? So it's a time machine. Now you're probably sick of hearing that. But it does offer a window on epochs we can't usually learn about, because Thomson scattering is pretty efficient. What it gives us a window on is redshifts between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 6, and even lower. And let me sketch out the relevant processes. At really high redshifts, past about 1 million, these processes, Bremsstrahlung and double Compton scattering, where you take one photon and get two out or vice versa, those are very efficient at changing photon number. So if you dump a whole bunch of energy into the cosmic plasma at those times, you get the black body back. Can't do anything about that. But slightly later, these two processes freeze out, and all you have is energy-changing Compton scattering. So that's not you're not in the Thomson regime yet, but you can't get rid of photons. You can only change their energy. And so those are associated with chemical potential type distortions. I'll say a little bit more about how they get there. And so if we're able to measure those, we actually have a window on the thermal history of the universe between a redshift of 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 6. I think our only other window on such high redshifts is possibly gravitational waves or a cosmic neutrino background, which are also very hard to detect. At lower redshifts, you don't even have this reaction. You can't efficiently change energy through Compton scattering, but you still have elastic Compton scattering, better known as Thomson scattering, and then you'll introduce a Compton Y-type distortion. And let me actually show you what these look like and tell you a little bit more about how the distortion evolves and develops. So here is a CMB frequency space distortion spectrum differenced relative to the black body. And the blue curve and red curve show mu and y distortions with different amplitudes. And you can see that the shapes are different. And one thing that's worth dwelling on for just a second is that the amplitudes of the mu and y type distortions are different by a factor of 5. And that's just an artifact of the parameter choice. So that's something to guide your eye to remember, that there's sort of a rough correspondence for the same physical distortion in amplitude. The mu-type distortion that you need to make that actual physical distortion is something like a factor of 5 to 6 bigger than the y-type distortion. So how do you actually generate these? Well, there are many ways, but one way is the superposition of black body. If we imagine, the primordial plasma with density fluctuations in it, and say I'm a dumb observer, who can't tell the difference between the intensity coming from here and from here. And I just measure one number, or a bunch of numbers, the intensity at a bunch of frequencies. The frequency spectrum I'll see if I superimpose this black body with that black body with a whole bunch of other black bodies is something like this red dotted curve. It's not just the superposition of these two black bodies here, which yields you the black curve. So there's some change in the CMB frequency spectrum when you superimpose two black bodies that can't just be written as a change in the temperature. And so unless something can eat up that distortion, namely those processes I was just telling you about, you're left with a Y-type distortion. And that Y-type distortion then gets thermalized into a mu-type distortion. So maybe I'm a little confusing here. So what happens, you inject energy here or here, you start with a Y-type distortion. If you're in this epoch, this process will take that Y distortion and turn it into a mu distortion because you can change photon energies. If you inject energy photons at this epoch, you can't even change their energies efficiently, and you're left with a overall Y-type distortion. So what are some of the interesting early universe physics you can learn about, or any new physics? Well, if dark matter, oh, perfect timing. Tracy Slater just walked in. If dark matter annihilates during that epoch, you can actually see a chemical potential or Y-type distortion depending on the dark matter annihilation cross-section. Alternatively, you can learn about primordial physics. Remember, we have no idea what the power spectrum is on these tiny scales that are entering the horizon then. So some of the things you could look for, and the list certainly goes on, but here's a few. You could look for steps in the primordial power spectrum, bumps in the primordial power spectrum, features from inflationary particle production, a running mass inflaton, gauge boson production from cosmic strings, damping of primordial magnetic fields. The basic physics, though, I want to distinguish everything starting right about here, except for these pesky gauge bosons. These are all processes in which you somehow introduce additional fluctuation or less fluctuation power on very small scales. You're stirring up the acoustic plasma a little differently. But the physics is just physics we know about in terms of how you actually get the distortion. You're just putting more energy in the perturbations on those scales. Let me flesh that out a little bit. So if we didn't have silk damping, which is just due to the destruction of the acoustic wavefronts due to the diffusion of photons out of acoustic wavefronts, because photons aren't a perfect fluid, we would just have a CMB power spectrum that looked like this undamped red line. But the perturbations do damp, and you end up with the observed anisotropy spectrum. So we might get depressed and say that information's lost to us forever, but actually, all this silk damping does, if you think about what this diffusion is doing, is it's telling these neighboring black bodies about each other. They're talking to each other. You're creating this Y-type distortion, and then you get a mu distortion out. Now, all of this can be made much more quantitative. You know, what I've just said comes out of solving the Boltzmann equation. I'm just trying to give a quick heuristic picture of what's going on. And so for our favorite scale-invariant lambda, nearly scale-invariant lambda CDM cosmology, you actually have a potentially observable signal, a chemical potential of a few parts in 10 to the 8, and a Y-type distortion of a few parts in 10 to the 9. Now, the actual answer is actually very model dependent. So here's a plot with way too many lines on it from a paper by Jens, who is in all other respects awesome, but sometimes likes lots of lines. So let me break down this plot. What's plotted here is the chemical potential type distortion as a function of the spectral index of the fluctuations.
Question.
Yeah.
Before you go into this, we do expect this just from late time, this kind of distortion just from late time.
Right.
Physics, like clusters and stuff. So wouldn't that be like more fundamental limit?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So the nice thing is that it's, as far as I know, there's no way to cook up the mu type distortions with late time physics. Yes, absolutely. So there are SZ type effects. You have all the clusters in the universe. You have, you know, the whole universe reionizing, presumably inhomogeneously. And so that's absolutely right. It gives you, just to maybe for orders of magnitude, that gives you, and I was going to say this later, it gives you a Y type signal of one part in 10 to the 7. So Y is fairly hopeless. Practically, but I don't know of any way to fake a mu-type distortion. There's certainly relativistic corrections to the ordinary SZ,
yeah.
But those still don't look like mu, as far as I know. But
they don't exactly look like mu, but they don't exactly look like Y either.
That's right. That's right.
So it's something that you might marginalize.
Probably, yeah, yeah. I suspect that's more of an effect in clusters than in the reionizing universe.
But relativistic would be, of course, bigger in clusters.
Right. No, but that's something important to be aware of. So the different curves here show different values of the running of the spectral index. And so the Pixie target sensitivity is this line right here. And what is this blue line? This blue line results from the fact that independent of what the perturbations are doing, the electrons are adiabatically cooling, and the photons are scattering off of those electrons. And that's going on during the distortion epoch. So you're actually losing energy just due to the homogeneous cooling of the electrons. And so that actually produces a negative mu-type distortion with this amplitude. So there's sort of two ways to spin this, of course. You could think, well, any model that predicts a distortion below this line is going to be killed. But it's also sort of, there's an interesting way of turning it around, of course, which is that anything that produces a distortion of this amplitude, a null signal will actually be telling you something that, you know, will be telling you that that power spectrum is consistent with the data or not. Now, it's not exactly null, right? You just need a better and a better instrument to actually see something. The other thing that's sort of interesting here in this plot is if you look at our preferred value of the spectral index at NS of 0.96, there are values of the running that seem not unreasonable, especially given some of the low L tension that's now been seen between Planck and Bicep, where you also might not see much signal at all. Point being, the very details of the very small scale power spectrum are very important to actually sorting out if there's any signal. And let me actually get a little more concrete about what I mean by small scales. So the galaxy power spectrum probes wave numbers between 0.01 and 0.3 inverse megaparsec. OK, I've said inverse megaparsec. I'll now just give you numbers. You all know the units. The CMB probes wave numbers between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 1. Lyman alpha forest maybe gets you up to 10. But of course, there's all the interesting physics of the IGM you have to be careful with. 21 centimeter cosmology may get up to K of 100. So that's the one thing that can compete. Whereas mu-type distortions can get you between a wave number of 50 and 10 to the 4. This is just taking those redshifts and mapping them onto the length scales that cross the horizon at those redshifts. So how do you actually compute things? Well, in reality, what you do is you can write down a heating rate, which is proportional to the Thomson scattering rate, and then is proportional to the values of all the different multiple moments in the Boltzmann hierarchy. You have contributions from polarization, and then you have the full hierarchy of Boltzmann moments. And so what you really do, and this is not at all obvious, by the way, it took a lot of hard work by Jens to show that this is the case, is it turns out to be you write down a second order Boltzmann equation, which is just a complete mess. And what can be shown is that to calculate this distortion, the perturbations themselves can actually just be evolved to first order. You can show that the second order pieces don't contribute to the global spectral distortion. And it's really good that that's the case, because otherwise we'd have to work way harder to predict anything. So what we've done with Jens is use his Cosmotherm Boltzmann code to actually calculate the spectral distortion produced by primordial isocurvature modes. See, 29 minutes into the talk, I've connected the two things I'm talking about. So what is the answer? The details aren't so interesting of the computation. So what am I showing here? Can you guys all like auto-complete these words?
Yeah.
OK. Here's the heating rate of the primordial plasma. The black curve is, and this is for a spectral index of 1, just for illustration. The black curve is the adiabatic mode. You sort of heat, you get a peak when modes are dissipating most efficiently around redshift of 1100. And then the heating rate falls off just as photons completely free stream out of potential wells. You have no acoustic perturbations, no damping, no energy left to tap for your spectral distortions. And the red curves are the two different neutrino isocurvature modes I was telling you about before. And you can see that they more or less track the heating rate from the adiabatic mode. And the thing, I'll explain it a little more in a second, but the thing to remember is these are relativistic particles. So it stands to reason that their behavior is something similar to like just what a overall fluctuation in the photon density is. But if you plot for a scale invariant spectrum the contribution of baryon or cold dark matter fluctuations to the heating rate, this is the energy that then turns into mu, you see you're highly suppressed at high redshift. And the reason is actually simple to understand. If you think about what an isocurvature perturbation does, crudely speaking, if you want to be anthropomorphic about it, it wants to maintain this condition. Can everyone read that? So you set up some perturbation in some species here, and the compensating fractional perturbation in the photons, which is what starts all this oscillation to begin with, is just delta gamma is equal to negative rho I over rho gamma delta I. So if this is a neutrino isocurvature fluctuation, this is just something like the energy fraction in neutrinos, which is of order the photon energy density during the radiation-dominated epoch. But if this is cold dark matter, if you're in the radiation-dominated epoch, well, by definition, this is a very small number. So the actual fluctuation you set up in the baryon photon fluid for these non-relativistic isocurvature modes is a much smaller fluctuation. And the only way to increase the signal from these non-relativistic parts of parameter space is if you make those really small scale non-relativistic fluctuations really high amplitude. If you put in a really blue spectrum, you can sort of find your way back up towards the adiabatic curve. And that's what I'm showing here. With a very blue spectral index, the CDM isocurvature, in this case assumed to be uncorrelated, can actually generate as strong or even a stronger signal than the adiabatic mode. Yes? Right. So what happens is it's all gravitational physics. So the neutrinos eventually seed gravitational potential perturbations. The isocurvature condition breaks as things redshift. And so you end up with a gravitational potential perturbation that the photons then fall into. So sort of the fact that you need to be mediated by gravity is why, you know, you're not just up by the adiabatic curve. So all the curves I've shown you so far are for uncorrelated isocurvature, for example, of the axion flavor. But you could also consider curvanton type modes. This is a depressing part of the project. There are actually 18 different curvanton scenarios, because you can see, maybe it's even 27, actually there are 27, but some of them map onto each other. So for lepton number, baryon number, and cold dark matter, for each of those species, you can say, was it generated before curviton decay, by curviton decay, or after curviton decay? So just do 3 to the 3, and you have 27 possibilities. And there's two free parameters. One is the energy fraction in curvitons at the time it decays, and the other is the lepton asymmetry of the universe. That's only relevant for the neutrinos. And it turns out that for all 27 of these scenarios, the curviton contribution to the spectral distortions... Yes?
Is that with reheating of the curviton or the interton? When you talk about the lepton number generation...
That is... Are you asking how lepton number is generated? It is, in this case, it's assumed to be through curviton decay, because this was a year-old paper written before we knew about BICEP and the fact that curviton models might require an admixture of inflaton and curviton. I know you had a very nice paper on this last week, so we should certainly consider that case, because things might be a little more optimistic, but we haven't gotten around to it. So simple curviton models are not a promising target for spectral distortion experiments. And here I actually take the mu and compare it with experimental sensitivities. So the x-axis here is the index of the perturbations. A is their amplitude. And blue lines are limits from CMB anisotropies. And let's just ignore COBE for now, because this is a rich plot for better or for worse. We see that for a spectral index past 1, the limits both for mu and y-type distortions with PIXI are more stringent than direct measurements of the fluctuations. Of course, physically, these are happening on a very different scale. And the other neat thing to see is that all these curves are actually... The red curves are the predicted limits on adiabatic and neutrino isocurvature modes from the PIXI mission. The black curves are the equivalent limits from y-type distortions. So frankly, I think you could probably ignore the black curves because we're never going to measure those. But the chemical potential is more promising. So for a spectral index that's just a little bit blue, you will do better with PIXI and measuring the power spectrum on these very small scales than you would from just extrapolating the observed anisotropies out to these scales. So that's another thing to keep in mind, that this is more powerful because this is actually a direct measurement of power on these scales. You're not just taking K at a pivot of 0.05, saying, oh, it extends with that index all the way out to high K, and what limit do I put on things? And in both cases, you're doing much better than COBE-FIRAS.
What are those thin red lines?
The thin red lines are the limits from COBE-FIRAS on the same exact scenarios. Yeah, I think I need to spend some more time with Illustrator on this plot. So these are all for the relativistic sort of scenarios, you know, neutrino density, adiabatic, and neutrino velocity. You can also look at the non-relativistic modes. And this is the same sort of plot. And please stop me to explain lines, because I know this plot is hard to read, so I'm happy to do that. So here, we've shown the limits on the baryon and cold dark matter type isocurvature fluctuations that you'd get both with COBE-FIRAS and with PIXI. So just to keep things simple, let's look at the red lines here. These are baryon and cold dark matter isocurvature fluctuations. And this is interesting, because you only see improved sensitivity over PIXI when you have a very blue, you only see improved sensitivity over direct measurements of the anisotropies when you have a very blue spectral index. And the physics is just what I was sketching out on the board there, that these are highly suppressed initial photon density perturbations. But again, the potential strength is, even though you need this fairly exotic spectral index, this is, in principle, a direct measurement of power on these scales. And just to stress the point that the details of the spectrum do matter, this is a plot from one of Jens's earlier papers considering different inflationary scenarios. And all that's plotted here is the spectral index, the running, and then this floor is this balanced injection scenario I was talking about, where you have the contribution from adiabatic cooling. And so if you just look at what you would get if you just use WMAP7 best fit values, you have something that's marginally detectable by PIXI. But if you have running, if you include the best fit running index and just extrapolate the power spectrum to those scales, You'd need a much better instrument to actually detect this. So you can sort of think of this as a weakness or a strength, right? You're very sensitive to the strength of the primordial power spectrum on small scales, but I think it's hard to keep a straight face and say you have a robust prediction. But if you're sending a $2 billion CMB B-mode polarization degree scale experiment into space, this is a very cheap thing to throw on, and we can measure the spectrum much better to try to constrain some of these scenarios. Just doing a little bit of peeling things off of other... Sorry, say that again?
This is a very cheap thing, too.
The spectrometer itself is very cheap once you have a CMB satellite in space. So Pixie costs $200 million because they're, you know, going after B-modes. Prism is $2 billion, but that's mostly the 10,000 bolometers, you know, that they're putting on.
Are the specs for Prism, does it include the spectrometer?
Yes.
It does. Okay.
Yes. I think there was some controversy about that, though, so I don't...
But I guess the foreground cleaning, I think that's a bit
arbitrary. Yeah. This is by no means definitive, but I just looked at a PDF file Anthony Lewis threw on the web a few days ago where he run like 20 permutations of Monte Carlos. And if you put in his best fit value for the running that sort of cooks up consistency between WMAP TT and BICEP, you actually end up very close to one of these balanced injection scenarios. But again, this requires a huge running of the spectrum over many scales. So it's just an extrapolation. Another sort of other neat fact, I'm shamelessly trying to make my talk relevant to current events, you know, so if you look at one of the most surprising things about what I call highbrow particle theorists, about, there are a few of them in the room here, about the detection of gravitational waves, if you ask what kind of field excursion is necessary in a slow roll, simple, single field inflationary model, if you ask, you know, If the inflationary potential is this high and slow roll, R essentially sets how high up you start. And if you're slow roll, you can ask how quickly the field rolls down the potential. And when you just impose slow roll consistency requirements, the field rolls over a length that's of order a Planck mass. And this makes effective field theorists very nervous. One way around these is some inflationary models of Bendayan and Brustein that essentially have some non-monotonic behavior in the inflationary potential. I don't personally know why that would make an effective field theorist any happier, but if you put in that sort of a potential, this introduces a lot of features in the primordial power spectrum. It would, you know, at least at the model building level, give you a way to make Planck TT and BICEP agree, and that would predict a huge spectral distortion of 1 part in 10^6. So there are some interesting possibilities there. How am I doing on time? Oh, I have quite a bit of time. Okay, good. Oh, yeah, I have 20 minutes. 15. Okay. So we'll do choose your own adventure or something later. So I just want to take a few moments to advertise a paper I've almost finished I should have put my collaborator here, but he's on the next slide. So we've considered a different scenario entirely. Some of you might remember that before the boomerang came back with these beautiful acoustic peaks, topological defect models for structure formation were quite competitive with the inflationary model. And so let me just quickly say in words the sort of model we're thinking about. You can imagine some field with a Mexican hat potential. I don't know why we can't imagine something better, but that's what we imagine. And you could imagine that you have N field components. And you imagine that some sort of global symmetry breaking occurs. The field spontaneously breaks symmetry, finds its vacuum. And you can imagine that you're pointing at a different field space, a different vacuum, in different causally disconnected volumes when this transition takes place. For example, maybe at the gut scale or something like that. And what's interesting is that these sorts of phase transitions, if you require yourself to be on the vacuum manifold everywhere in space, somewhere on this little annulus, this beautiful self-similarity pops out of the problem. Essentially, let's just take the two-dimensional case so we have a picture in mind. If you sprinkle a bunch of arrows on the floor in random directions, the arrows are all going to roughly line up in a horizon-sized volume because they're able to causally interact and line up. But otherwise, you sort of have a random realization here. But as the cosmic horizon grows, know, these, and this arrow will all sort of line up to point in a given direction, an appropriate average of those four. And so as you look at the amplitude of density fluctuations in this network, it's sort of like a texture, or some people call them non-topological defects, you will always have order unity fluctuations in the density of this field on the scale of the horizon. And the resulting gravitational potential wells, which are small, linear, and well-behaved, will then provide a seed for photons to fall into. And this will excite additional acoustic waves in the plasma, and these will damp. And so CMB spectral distortions offer one more window on this sort of scenario. And even though these sorts of seeds are now known to be probably less than 5% of the CMB fluctuations on large scales, they actually overtake the adiabatic fluctuations on small scales. So it stands to reason they might have some sort of interesting imprint on spectral distortions. So this project has been a long road that started by having something to do with axions that I don't even remember. Actually, I think it started in Aspen 2 years ago or something like that. And this is work we've been doing with Mustafa Amin. So, you know, we wrote our own CMB slow, which lives inside Mathematica. We evolve a fair number of moments in the neutrino hierarchy. We use conformal Newtonian gauge, which nobody likes, but we like it. And we asked what a photon density perturbation does. And it comes into the horizon. It grows up to a fairly large amplitude. It enters the acoustic oscillation regime, and it silk damps. And the amount of energy you get through silk damping, which determines the mu distortion, you're essentially just measuring the height of this plateau. And the height of this plateau is set by the details of the actual seed model you're considering. So we have an answer. It's a few parts in 10 to the minus 9, which is less than the most naive adiabatic prediction. But as I've tried to stress, the field is sort of wide open here. The one caveat I'd give to these results that may boost up this answer even more is that, unlike adiabatic fluctuations, these seed models actually always excite vector and tensor perturbations. And I think we've convinced ourselves that those damp so much when they enter the horizon that they're not relevant for the acoustic fluctuation-sourced distortions. But that sort of aspect of it is a work in progress.
So does that, I noticed on the previous slide, delta rho over rho depended on the BEV.
That's right. Right.
So
right.
Is this for a particular assumption? Like, does delta rho over rho have to be large enough?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what we did was we took the limits from, Planck actually has a whole paper on topological defects, so we saturated their upper limit. And when you saturate their upper limit, you then get a prediction. Now, what I'm not sure about is the Planck polarization results may be very strong, a very strong constraint on these models as well. Because remember, one of the weird things about these models is they, like isocurvature, they mess up the phase structure of the CMB acoustic peaks. In some sense, more violently, because they just give you these C sub L that are bumps, essentially. And so they're pretty tightly constrained. So, of course, that prediction that Planck will do such a good job of ruling out these models was predicated on the assumption that the B-mode signal itself was basically zero. So once you put in sample variance from the B-modes, I don't know how that'll affect your prediction for how well you'll constrain these models with Planck. But by the way, sorry, I mean, it's not my work. I just think BICEP is so great. Like, they actually, if the result is correct, it's actually a sample variance limited measurement of the B modes. They are not limited by instrument noise, which I think is just incredible.
So one other question then. I'm a bit confused because you said something was order one on the scale of the horizon.
Yeah.
Delta rho over rho or something else?
So the full equation is actually delta rho over rho is the energy scale of this new transition over the Planck scale squared times basically some number of order unity. So if you had put in the Planck scale here, you would have density fluctuations of order unity, which generally is something that would make you nervous doing perturbation theory. But if you saturate the Planck limits, this number is more like 10 to the minus 2, or a few parts 10 to the minus 2. So we're still reasonably comfortable with perturbation theory. But if this were all of the fluctuation power, right? If there was no inflation and all the power we see in the universe was sourced by these seeds, then you would have to drive this number up to of order unity. And so then it would be sort of hard to do perturbation theory. So in some sense, I guess we're fortunate that we don't have to do that, but it also means that model can't explain everything.
Why you want the unity? I mean, it's 10 to the minus 5 is delta over rho.
Hold on. There's the density fluctuation in the photons, and there's the density fluctuation in this field. So I think the point is just that if you want this to be all the primordial fluctuation, there's another numerical prefactor here, which converts to the induced photon fluctuation. There's another numerical prefactor which converts you to the induced photon fluctuation from these. Yeah, I think it's basically omega.
Let me think about that. So the idea that at some point in the early universe you have a phase transition that happens, maybe use the topological defects, and they dissipate when they enter the horizon.
That's right. That's right.
So the point is that the fluctuations should be avoided until the minus 5 if they want to match. I mean, I guess the problem is that spectrum doesn't match that move point.
Right, right. But I think you might be right about the numerology here, so let me actually just say what I know. And what I know is that for our parameter choice, the fluctuation is something like 10 to the minus 7, because the constraint is 1% of the 10 minus 5. I think you're probably right, actually, that it's not quite order unity, but it's starting to get uncomfortably big. I had a whole bunch of other stuff, but I think now is actually a good time to stop and take any further questions. So.
Right.
So are you thinking of just evaporating and injecting energy into the CMB? Like from evaporation, is that the channel? Or accretion?
Maybe even forget about primordial black holes, but maybe stuff like this in general where I have seeds. I mean, I guess you would imagine that the gravitational wells associated with those seeds would cause all sorts of things to be happening on small scales.
Right.
And some of that energy would be dissipated.
The thing I'm a little worried about, and again, this comes back to one of the weaknesses that I don't think people often talk about this approach, is anything that is an object and that you are sprinkling down, defects, black holes, I mean, up to factors of order unity, what you're getting is a Poisson power spectrum. And I don't know how distinguishable they are. But if you're happy with the constraint, I guess if you have some model for... what you could do for a simple estimate is if you have some model for how many primordial black holes I expect inside a causal horizon, just say the Poisson power spectrum is something like 1 over the average number density. So put your number in there, put that in, and let that source causal fluctuations. Now, the one difference, sorry, I'm sort of thinking on the fly, and I don't really know the answer to your question, is... and this will be clear in the paper if I talk more about this part of things, is in these cases, even though the density fluctuations of these guys are Poisson, the resulting potential power spectrum is not Poisson. It's more like a scale invariant power spectrum. And that's essentially due to the way the field responds. You have this very nice scaling property. And I don't know if you just took black holes and threw them down. You know, you're not, I think the point is what happens, so say you have one primordial black hole per horizon volume, right? And say those two horizons meet. What are they gonna do? They'll probably never see each other, right? So I think you would just keep the power. I think it would be similar actually. But it's worth checking.
What is this field whose vacuum expectation value is not zero?
I don't know. You could imagine maybe a gut phase transition. You could say that we don't necessarily have evidence of global symmetry breaking in physics. That would be a fair point. But people certainly write down global phase. I mean, one global phase transition would be the Pecci-Quinn phase transition. But that, the Pecci-Quinn case actually corresponds to the case where you just have a single complex field. And in that case, this sort of defect is the least of your worries. You have cosmic strings running around everywhere. And those would actually also source spectral distortions. So one thing we haven't done in this paper is a careful computation of the string-sourced spectral distortion. But there's a nice paper by Tanmay Vachaspati where he actually computes the string-sourced distortion from that sort of a, you know, basically n equals 1 phase transition. And he gets a very small number. So that's sort of a puzzle. You know, why is the string case so different, or is it? So it'd be nice to see some details of their calculation.
So I guess the idea, this is what people call texture, is this thing that you're
making? Texture is the n equals 4 case.
Okay.
And we work in the large n limit, which is strictly something called a, I think David or Neil came up with the term non-topological defect. So that's what these are. Yeah, but basically these unwind for any given scale. If you're talking about the defectiness of the network on some scale, that scale is just unwinding at today's age. Basically, the defect on the scale of today's horizon at time t is unwinding just by today. And the defects on larger scales will unwind later. So whereas a string just sticks around, right? The domain wall sticks around. And is actually, this is something I was wondering, which is when we sort of categorize topological defects, the string case is thought to be, OK, that's a little upsetting, but I could go detect it, and maybe it's there. Defects are a complete catastrophe. They overtake the energy. Sorry, domain walls are a complete catastrophe, and they overtake the energy density of the universe. And then you go back to monopoles, and it's, again, not a catastrophe. So what's so special about n equals 2? Does anyone know? Like, why do you get something really bad for domain wall and everything else is more or less OK, at least as far as like the thermal history?
Monopoles are a catastrophe too. That's more of a problem.
Because they haven't been detected? Or?
No, but they overcloud the
universe. Sorry, but I think it says monopoles and domain walls are catastrophes, but the strings are not catastrophes.
Oh, I thought you were just saying monopoles were.
I was saying they work, but let's actually pursue that for a second. Let's say monopoles are a catastrophe.
Yeah.
Let's say domain walls.
Right,
right. And let's say domain walls are a catastrophe. You still have this non-monotonicity in how bad things are, right? At n equals 1, you have a string, which you're more or less OK with. Then you run for an n equals 2 or 3 manifold. You have these catastrophes. And then n equals 4, you hit this texture case and these non-topological defects. Right.
In the string case, there's scaling, behavior because they're constantly.
Isn't that the whole string aspect of the thing? Like strings preferentially collide in previous one dimensions.
It's
something to do with intersecting strings.
It's just the evolution of the network is different. And so the energy density dilutes differently if I have points or lines or sheets.
I guess strings can reconnect. And maybe domain walls can't, is that?
Well, domain walls will reach each other. But I think the reason why they are like catastrophic people, monopoles is not the same one. Domain walls are catastrophic. So it's not that continuous.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think actually the strings, if they didn't reconnect, I think all of them would be catastrophe, right? The strings.
It would be catastrophe up to, it would be monotonic then.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think maybe the monopoles miss each other.
Now, do all strings reconnect, or just global strings or local strings?
No. You can do models where you allow it. I mean, there are some strong constraints on what the energy density of the strings has to be, but there are models that are claimed to be sensible, which are not obviously robust at least as yet.
Any more questions for them? Okay, before we thank them again, then just a reminder that. General Club today at 4 in here, and also that at 6 p.m. we will be going for dinner as usual in the bistro with Dan. Students and postdocs will be catered for. And see you all later. Let's thank Dan again.